UK Motor Talk.
Well, hello everyone. I'm Mike.
I'm Jim. Hello.
I'm Graham. Good evening to you all.
And I'm Dave still. How are we all doing? It's been a couple of weeks. Have we all been doing anything exciting?
Yes, the Caterham is taxed and has been out on the road because we've had some actual sunny weather at weekends, which is an absolute miracle. Yeah, it's. I mean, although the other day the weather is very peculiar at work. We had bright sunshine and hail at the same time. Could barely see a cloud in the sky, but somehow it was hailing, which was very peculiar.
The end times.
No, I've had a couple of trips out in it, actually. It's been rather nice, so it's been well worth the £30 road tax or whatever I've paid this month for my two drives in it. So there we are, £15 a drive well spent just to hunt out some potholes. But that's a you can refer to previous episodes for our thoughts on potholes.
I think all of my cars are currently taxed, which is ruinous, because what between the Mini, which is £400 a year, the Focus, which is £200 something a year, the Onion, which is £200 a year, I don't even want to think about it. The monthly tax bill is certainly more than the monthly insurance bill. It's a lot, anyway.
I should go for non-dom status if I were you.
You never know. The Onion is idling, finally. It idles, it doesn't rev up to 4,000 RPM.
Have you found the air leak, then? Where was the air leak?
Well, I'm not entirely sure, but I have fixed the problem.
Has it gone away on its own?
I have had to do lots of things to get there, and I'll explain all of these things on the build thread on our YouTube channel. So if you want to see more about that, look at UK Motor Talk on YouTube and you'll be able to see the full build of the Onion, and that will be coming up. But fundamentally, I think I've just improved tolerances a bit and got something which allows you to smooth over the face of the side of the engine, or the side of the head. And if it's not quite perfect, allow it to seal perfectly. And that seems to have cured the issue. And I've been speaking to the tuner today, where the vehicle's going, which is up at Ignition Advantages up in Epping, who provided the kit in the first place, and said because the idle's just slightly off, so it's idling just a little bit too low, and apparently I just need to run the cartlets hot and then just tell it this is where I want it to idle and it will do it. So I've got a little bit of tuning to do just to make it sit nicely so that it can be ready to be loaded on the truck and taken up and mapped properly. But it's got to the point where I might actually be able to enjoy it in the summer, if we get a summer this year. So you never know.
Or if we already had the summer. Have you missed it? Have you missed the boat already? We might have had the two sunny weekends that we're going to get this year, and that's it.
It did top out 17 degrees, didn't it, the other day? So possibly yes. Mm. But we seem to be going through this weird cycle at the moment where you can drive into work, and it's a beautiful sunny day, and it feels properly like spring. And then it gets to, I don't know, lunchtime, and it's hailing, or tipping it down, or sideways, you know, with fog and just complete cloud. Goodness knows. The weather is just, I've no idea what it's currently doing.
I'm really hoping for an improvement in the weather. I've spent several days prepping the bongo for its first expedition of the year.
What have you packed in your bongo?
It's not about packing. I've just sort of gone through and serviced everything. And it's the only vehicle I've ever owned where you had to lift the front seats to service anything. Because it's just very strange to have to put oil and pour it in under the front seat. But there you go. It's a weird setup, but it works.
I'm a liability for this because despite the fact that I have a perfectly good funnel, it's always wedged down the wrong side of the car when I need it. So when you go to top the oil, I was like, I'll just chance it. It'll be fine. I'll just turn the bottle sideways and just tip it in.
Nah,
and you can guarantee you'll have a little dribble. And you don't want that inside your car, do you? What's made matters worse is I've done a little dribble, but onto the heat wrap. And of course, that will now smoke for approximately 4.5 years every time the engine gets hot until it finally dries itself out.
That's good. That will smell quite nice, though.
It smells like a two-stroke.
It's okay if you know what and where and how and why it's happening, but it's not a reassuring smell when driving a car, is it?
My neighbour, who's a biker, came running out, A, because he heard the car start and was excited about the fact that he could hear it running for the first time in goodness knows how long, probably a year and a half, maybe, I reckon, since it last ran. Or last round properly, but also because he could smell two-stroke, which is presumably the pure fuel coming out the back of the car and the oil burning off the exhaust manifold. So, yeah, it's a fantastic smell. He says it just smells like it's on fire. But yeah, I'm sure that's right.
I have the same thing as you with the oil and the not being able to find the funnel. And every time my car goes to the garage for service, they go, either you've been trying to fill it up without a funnel again, or you've got a slight leak. And he said, it's probably the former, so we'll just let it go for now.
Having finally solved the Volvo's sort of massive oil leak, and that was sort of harking back to the earliest days of motoring, a sort of total loss oil system. But I can take the Bongo off the road and get it ready for what it's intended for, which is to go camping.
Well, there's a bank holiday coming, so don't bother there, because you can guarantee that'll be tipping down.
Oh, don't say that. We're booked onto a family camping festival up at the South of England Showground, which is all for camper vans, so we're sort of blooding ourselves with that.
Oh, that'd be good. Well, you just put sort of, everyone puts an awning up, and you'll all be undercover from sort of one side of Ardingly to the other.
I've heard that camping is definitely one of those shared experiences, so I'm sure you'll enjoy.
I hope so.
Yeah, keep us posted. It sounds like fun.
Well, there's loads of bands every night and outdoor cinema and all kinds of family stuff. So.
Is this the one we can go monster truck driving or monster truck riding?
Don't think so.
I've seen one of these coming up, and just fit big wheels to the Bongo, I suppose you could, couldn't you? Just take that off-roading right. Instead. Get some knobblies for it.
If I was going to do that, I think I'd want a big set of wheels at the back and a smaller set at the front, and possibly put a blower up through the roof and drag race it.
I like the idea of it.
We used to take, when we were drag racing, which is a long time ago now, the VW camper that we had then, because that basically was the base, and we fed the whole crew out of the camper van. Pete and Phil and so on, and their families all slept in the trailer once the vehicle was out.
What was that import you could get that had four wheel drive and was a sort of day van type thing? It had a swing wheel on the back, and that was sort of like an MPV shape. I'm sure they were only an import thing.
Oh,
it must
I know
have been
the one.
A Toyota or a Mitsubishi or something.
An Alphard?
Sure, come back to me.
I know the
now,
one.
Alphards are cool. I do like those things. But no, it was like a proper, it was a proper four-wheel drive jobby, wasn't it? It had raised ground clearance and everything else. You know the one I mean? I have to come back to that later, I think. It'll bug me. You're probably shouting at your radio, smart speaker, phone, whatever it is now. You know exactly what it is.
Are you thinking Unimog or something like that?
No, although that would be cool as a camper. They're absolutely huge, aren't they?
It certainly would be. Yeah.
There's like a little JDM thing, and it was the same sort of shape as a small MPV. And I think
exactly
the seats went flat in the back.
Mean.
And they were always on sort of like bigger steel wheels, weren't they, with knobblies on. You'd see them everywhere. It was the same sort of era that you could get an enema. No, emina. And an estima and all that sort of thing. It was that same. It looked
probably still
a bit
can
like
get an enema, to be fair.
Well, yes, possibly whilst camping. I'm sure it'll come back to me later.
I know exactly the one you meant. That was a 4x4.
They're all disappearing off to the States because they keep coming up on Doug DeMuro's cars and bids. They don't seem to be able to get enough of them. The JDM thing over there is massive at the minute. And this is probably why we're not seeing them on British roads anymore, because someone's going, hang on a minute, I know where I can offload this. And Doug DeMuro does another little bit of wee in his trousers and another one appears on the market.
It was definitely Toyota.
Mitsubishi,
yes.
Delica.
Yes. Yeah, because I was thinking, is it a Delica or something? But Delica, yes, that would make sense.
So it's
Delica.
A Celica and a Delica.
Delica.
Though, yeah. What happened to the Elica and the Felica?
I have seen a couple. Nice looking vans.
I was convinced that it was going to be a Toyota something or other. But yeah, you're right. It's exactly that. Proper little off-road jobby. And there was like an overland vehicle, wasn't it? It was quite cool. A little JDM camper van. But I seem to remember them being around in the early noughties. They seem to be everywhere, but they just have all dropped off.
I don't know whether it's because I've got something like that now with a Bongo, but I keep seeing, certainly in Brighton, there's a lot of Japanese imports, Mazda, Toyota, Nissan, all converted into small motorhomes.
I think that's pretty cool, to be honest.
Yeah, some great looking ones. Some of the Toyota ones are very slightly bigger and sort of between the size of the Bongo and the VW camper, but without being any more expensive.
I've just looked at some pictures now, and it's definitely the Mitsubishi that Dave shouted out, the Leica or whatever it's going to be called.
Star Wagon.
That's it. Yes, yes. I think they did other kind of things, like they made it out of high aces and all that kind of caper as well.
Yeah, Toyota's was a high ace. Daihatsu high jet. Yeah.
High jet. There was an Isuzu Fargo, I think, was another.
Possibly. That's not what I remember. The Daihatsu Hi-Jet, I definitely remember those. And I know the Hi-Ace is the sort of the van of choice for basically most of the world to do something to, isn't it?
Yeah.
But the Mitsubishi Delica Star Wagon, that's definitely the one.
That's
but,
you the know, one.
Nudge bars, yellow yes. fog lights, a swing away rear wheel, like you say. And
yeah, you got it.
Basically, your home on wheels, and it will literally go up mountains and climb things and go through bogs and things. Should we just camp in the middle of this marsh? Why not? It'll be a laugh, because we can.
I'm sure I used to have like a little Corgi or a Majorette-style, that kind of size car, matchbox-sized car of that as a kid. What a random thing to have made a model or a toy of. I guess that there were more of those things around when I was a kid, maybe. I don't seem to remember there being many of the MPVs until... There was the odd Spass and such, but until the Galaxy and all that lot kicked off in the mid-90s. I seem to remember there being more of those JDM-type people wagons.
It was a big thing, wasn't there, in the sort of, basically the 90s, early 2000s, where Japanese imports were by far the sort of big thing to have. There were so many of these specialists springing up. There's a big one not a million miles away from us over in Dorking, which was called Japatrans, quite literally did what it said on the tin. And they did quite a roaring trade in Skylines, or the not quite the full fat Skylines, but the next one down. But they also did have a lot of the sort of thing we've been talking about, the Hi-Aces and the Delicas and Delicas, however you want to pronounce it.
Yeah, I think there was one not far east of Brighton, New Era Imports, and that was always a lovely website to browse through. But I think you can still look at all the sold stock and everything they had in the past and just sort of weep at some of the prices that were paid for what is now 100, 200 grand's worth of kit changing hands for 20 or 30. But at the time, it seemed like a lot of money, and you put it on the wish list for when you're older. But yeah, that was always a lovely website to gawk through and see all the pictures. But I think in general, buying anything from Japan was always a fairly safe bet, because the grading system through the auction seemed to be spot on, and there were always 3,000 pictures, and they'd point out every stone chip or whatever, not that there were many. And the underneath was always lovely and clean as well, because the roads are so much cleaner and not gritted. So the underneath of any car was superb. My friend's MR2, that was a Japanese import, the underneath was immaculate compared to mine and another friend's that had lived all their lives in the UK. So, yeah.
So a curious thing, there was a trend 2 or 3, 4 years ago to buy in ex sort of Russian military vehicles and convert them to go anywhere camper vans. And I remember seeing a few, but I haven't seen any for a while. I'm beginning to suspect the Russians have bought them all back again. Press them back into use.
They're probably in demand, aren't they, at the moment?
Yeah, I would think so, yes.
I see that we've, in the news, that we've sent something like 33 fire engines to Ukraine, actually, this week. 2 mechanics vehicles and an HGV carrying 2,800 pieces of equipment. And I know that our local fire service sent a load before now as well, which is quite interesting. There's been a few other bits and pieces in the news, hasn't there? I'll be very careful, for legal reasons, how I mention the next bit. But Dave, to absolve myself of risk, I understand that there's been some bits going on with Tesla.
Oh, yes. Be very careful what you say.
Well, no, this is from an investor. This is an investor meeting, because I do own 0.0000 something of a share in Tesla. So this is relevant. This is my company we're talking about.
You must now mute your microphone and take no further part in the proceedings, because there may be conflict of interest and impartiality rules being what they are. But
shares can go down as well as up. So
they've been going down 40%.
Yeah, gone down this week.
Since beginning of 40% since the beginning of the year, apparently. And a lot of it is being pinned on the 90-degree veer to the right that a certain person at the top of the company pulled not so long ago. He's definitely, if you go back a little bit, basically most of the early adopters of Tesla were probably to the left of center, people who want to save the planet, those who think that driving around in internal combustion engine vehicles is not a good thing for the environment, and you know that's rightly so. However, unfortunately, the man they were all rushing to buy their cars from has all of a sudden decided that the Republicans are the people that he really wants to woo, and as a result, most of the Democrats and anyone who's got a bit of a social conscience who was really in the middle of Tesla's sights for buying the cars seems to have gone, well, that doesn't really fit with my worldview anymore. And given that there's so many other people now bringing electric cars that are as capable, if not more capable, arguably, than Tesla to market, they've got plenty other choice to go and make. Oh, there's also the fact that there's the bad press they've been getting. I mean, they've dropped the price of their cars considerably because they were just stacking up, coming out of the factory and just sort of sitting there. No one was buying them. There's been mixed reviews of the Cybertruck, and they've all been recalled, lest we forget, because of a problem with the accelerator pedal, which is probably bringing a bit of a wry smile to people at Toyota, who had something similar happen a few years ago. it's not going so well for Elon. And then finally, just to sort of add on the back of this, there's the fact that anyone who sort of keeps their ears to the ground has been expecting the purported $25,000 Tesla, which would put Tesla within the financial reach of a lot more people, you know, because Tesla is associated with those who have a few more quid to spend. Apparently this has been canned, according to an insider, in favour of the robo-taxi project, which Elon is so fond of. So not a brilliant week. And then just finally, those who are really suffering with this, 10% of the staff are all being made redundant as a result. So not good at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a week for Tesla certainly a few weeks, to say the least. But yeah, the canning of the cheap EV is an interesting thing to pick up on, because we are seeing the start or the flood now of cheap EVs, everything from quads and heavy quadricycles, as they're called, in the Citroen AMI to the Dacia Spring that we've waxed lyrical about, you know, the Lamborghini-inspired Dacia Spring, as I was drunk and managed to convince myself that so. It looked like that. It definitely does. And there's all sorts coming onto the market that's far more reasonable in price. So I think to can, or, you know, to publicly can, even if you do it privately or put it on pause, you know, if you stretch the schedule by 6 months or 12 months, you don't particularly have to tell anyone, you just sort of get on with it later. Is that almost a deliberate thing to keep the perception and the prestige around the brand high? I mean, you know, we met up with a couple of friends at the weekend, and we were sat in the car park. We got there a bit early, so we'd gone for a wander and then came back to wait for them. And my daughter, who's 8 years old, said, "What car are they in?" And I said, "Oh, they've got a Tesla." She went, "Oh, they must be rich." I was like, "If you say so." And that just caught me off guard, because the car I drive around in is, I think the retail price is, give or take, it's the same price as theirs. But she never looks at my car and says, "Oh, you must be rich to have that car." So the perception, even amongst youngsters, is that Tesla's an expensive brand. But Elon had always said, you know, use the profits from one car to make the next one cheaper, and he did, and use the profits from that one to make the next one cheaper, and he did, and so on and so forth. But you get to a stage where is that worth it? I mean, I'm sure Ferrari could design a car that looks somewhat like a 488 or a 360 and put a 2-litre engine in it and call it a Dino and sell it for £60,000 or £50,000. They'd probably sell a gajillion of them. But do they want
Porsche.
To? Do they want to? No, because it then devalues the rest of the brand. You know, I'm sure Rolex could bring out a quartz plastic fabric strapped model and call it the Bob Mariner or something like that, but do they want to? No, they like their long waiting lists and their high price and whatever else. So it's where you want to position the brand, really, isn't it? But yeah, it's not done well for the share price. Or is he doing this because he wants to buy some of the shares back? He's done this before.
That's true. That's a cynical view as a shareholder, but you might well be right in that. That's
it's my 0.00001 shares worth, or whatever it is I own. I haven't checked.
Well, I think on the US market, I think the main model is just they've dropped $500 off that. And the story I read is that other markets will follow with similar sort of scale cuts in the retail prices in the very near future. So they are trying to buy market share back, by the sounds of it. I seem to think we've been here before with Ford, Chrysler, Chevrolet, etc., who all got into a battle, what was it, a decade ago perhaps, where they tried to buy back market share and nearly ruined themselves in the process. So maybe that created a precedent that he's following. Who knows?
Yeah, I think a race to the bottom on price is never the best way of doing things. You know, volume is vanity and profit is sanity. But the ripples that dropping $7,000 or $8,000 off each model caused last time with the PCP, which is what most people in this country buy a car on every couple of years, the PCP rate shot through the roof because the residuals tanked. You know, you knock $7,000 off the price of a new one, then that has a knock-on effect on the price of all the second-hand ones. So your actual monthly cost, because you end up financing the depreciation, increases, or at the very best case scenario, stays the same. So if you're a cash buyer, yes, it's great news. But if you've just bought one, it's not good news. So I think he managed to tee off a load of owners, existing owners, and then people that were looking to buy them. As I say, yeah, if you were paying cash for it, then it made it more affordable. But if you had everything lined up to buy one and PCP, you'd suddenly find your monthly payment shot through the roof. So it's not always a wise thing to just drop $10,000 off the price of a car and think that you'll sell more. But I think Ford paused production of Mach-E and was it F-150 Lightning other month. They produced zero EVs in a month, didn't make a single one, and that's quite worrying, bearing in mind all the Mach-Es are made in one factory and then shipped out all over the world. For the entire production run for the entire global EV offering to be zero from one of the world's biggest car manufacturers, that's very worrying. That's very worrying. I mean, the trend at the moment, I think, is more towards full hybrid or self-charging hybrid or whatever you want to call it, and plug-in hybrid for those that it suits. So we have seen a bit of a shift. I mean, I think electricity prices certainly haven't helped the EV adoption rates. You know, my Mach-E, when I first got it, to charge it up at home cost you a fiver. Now, if you charge it up and you're on a fairly standard tariff, that could be £30. So that's a hell of a jump. That's a hell of a change. It's, you know, like petrol going to £5 a litre rather than £5 a gallon. It's a big old jump, and couple that with the cold weather and the general rubbish weather, your range drops. It's everything, I think, just added up to be bad news for EVs, but we don't seem to have really recovered from it. And of course, if you're reliant on all of that as an EV manufacturer, as Tesla are, then you haven't got, at least Ford have got, internal combustion to fall back on, so they can just sell some more petrol and diesel powered pickup trucks and cars and SUVs and Mustang V8s and things like that. You know, they carry on selling stuff, but yeah, it's an odd one. But he's not daft, Elon Musk. Say what you like about the man, he's generally not stupid. There's always a master plan at the end of it, so what that is remains to be seen.
Well, he's in this country, at least in the UK, he's in a position where he could probably sell a huge amount of credits that he's got, carbon credits, against not having to worry about meeting emissions targets, because of course everything he sells is electric, so he could sell those to other manufacturers and probably make a killing from that, and then presumably offer the cars at less money anyway if he really wanted to, discount the cars against what he's selling them off at. It's a huge amount of money that people are going to have to find in manufacturers if they don't meet the emissions target, 121 grams of CO2 per kilometre. So for every gram that a manufacturer is over, it's £86 per car per gram is the fine. So if you've got a biggish fleet, so say for example your entire CV fleet, that works out something silly like, well, there's going to be millions, isn't it? It's going to be absolutely millions. It doesn't take long if you're selling 50,000 cars a year even. So let's work that out, shall we? Let's do some maths live on air here. Anyone got a calculator?
This will be dramatically shortened in the edit. We'll have the old dial-up internet sound inserted whilst Mike is just asking Jeeves what the answer is.
Calculator for iPad.
Oh, you have to download it. There isn't one on the iPad because Steve Jobs said he didn't want one.
This is ridiculous.
Allow me. Hang on.
Right.
What are you trying to work out? Give me the numbers.
Say you've got to get to 100... What did I say? It was 121 grams, didn't I?
Yep.
Yes. Right, so you've got to get to 121 grams of CO2, but say your average fleet CO2 is 125. So you're four over. You're four away. So it's £86 times four. And you sold 50,000 cars. That'd be a relatively small volume manufacturer, wouldn't it? But how much does that give you?
17,200,000. That's quite a lot.
There you go. That is a lot.
Nothing considerable.
So if you think if you're a big manufacturer, you're selling twice that, that suddenly becomes a very big problem. That's before you consider the fact that you also have to sell 22% of everything you sell as electric. And if you don't, the fine is £15,000 per car. So,
which if your entire factory production has shut down for a month, then that probably makes that target. That seems to indicate you're a little way off hitting that target, doesn't it?
You've been listening to UK Maths Talk. And if you really wanted some slightly more slicker maths, I'm sure The Economist probably has a podcast that would describe this better. But nevertheless, you get the picture. It's expensive. And frankly, manufacturers probably can't afford to spend that. It is just too much money for them to be able to find. So what's going to happen? It's really tricky. They're going to have to buy the credits from somewhere. They can borrow some for next year for EV targets and making sure that they get to the right place they need to be, or they can buy them from manufacturers that are EV heavy. And we've also said, of course, before now that they've left themselves exposed to manufacturers who are predominantly EV or producing EVs, who could now, if they wanted to, I mean, Tesla could very easily say, I'm going to create a petrol Fiesta. It goes against what Tesla are, but they could do it and they wouldn't have to worry about the emissions bits because they sell so much electric stuff. The whole anti-EV sentiment, I don't think it's range anxiety. I think it's charging anxiety, actually. People are worried about filling up rather than running out.
Yeah, actually, the range doesn't matter as long as the range is more than the distance between here and the next available reliable charger. The range doesn't matter, does it?
I think it's not one thing or another. It's a quite a complex basket of sort of general discontent with people who are not among the first adopters, not amongst the group which will buy their way into new technologies. And the sort of general rump of the car buying public, I think, have some resistance to EVs for a complex set of reasons. Yes, range is one, cost is another, the running costs are another. And, you know, just the adoption of a new and not well understood technology is another. And the fact that many garages are not well equipped to deal with either the servicing or repair of such vehicles and so on and so on and so on. I saw a survey today which was complaints to the garage official body, the increase in numbers generally. But it was interesting that buried amongst those figures was an increase in complaints about poor servicing to EVs and poor repairs to EVs. You know, it's a set of statistics that one delving into, which is neither the time and place to do so. But it just caught my eye that it's part of the general not quite ready to adopt the technology wholeheartedly. And I think the fact that the manufacturers seem to be recognising that now, and if you notice more and more of the glamorous car TV ads are self-charging EVs. They're hybrids of various sorts. And the number of pure EV TV ads, or at least those that I've seen, seems to be reducing.
It's just going with the market, isn't it? I mean, I think it's Nissan that is probably the one who's got the most pointed advert, where it's their car that it's driven by a fuel cell, so there isn't a direct petrol connection. It's not an ICE driving the wheels. It's rather something generating the volts and going into the battery to power the car. And they make quite a big point about the feel of electric without basically hint all the pain of the rest of it, which is what's perceived by the general viewers.
Their adverts make absolutely no sense. Every time one of their adverts comes on, it always says something ridiculous, like, who said electric can't be electrifying when it's in a car? No one said that.
No, exactly. No,
who said driving can't be exhilarating when it's electric? No one, not a single person. So, you know, who said the sun can't come up when it's daytime?
What are you on about? Sorry, I had been drinking a lot.
It's the ramblings of a moron.
You don't seriously expect to be informed by an advert, and particularly a TV advert. You know, it's 30 seconds of absolute bloody lunacy. There was a time when TV adverts were absolutely lunatic, and I've seen some classics over the many, many years, which are on the far out end of surrealism. But no, don't expect to be informed by a TV ad. It just doesn't happen.
Well, bring back Nicole getting married with a Renault Clio.
Anyway, moving on. Was anyone paying attention at the Chinese Grand Prix?
I was paying attention to the grass because you showed it to me and I thought it was hilarious.
Yes, we had two random talking points. Quite a good weekend, actually, because we had the first practice session at silly o'clock in the morning, and then sprint qualifying, and then the sprint itself, and then they've rejigged the format a bit. So after the sprint race, Parc Fermé opened up again, so you could make various changes to your setup, and then we had qualifying, and then we had the Grand Prix itself. So it was quite a good way of doing the weekend, actually. So apart from free practice, every time you watched a session, it counted for something. It was qualifying or the race. And I do always watch sprint quali or a sprint race and think, actually, yeah, that's better than watching free practice two or three. But we've had it a few times in the past where they've, you know, Parc Fermé starts at the beginning of sprint qualifying. So if your setup's rubbish, that's you for the weekend.
Definitely a much better format. And it did just produce some more interesting results. The sprint race was, I think, probably the more interesting of the two races, actually. I really enjoyed the sprint race.
Yeah, I think you're right. It was odd that it gave Lewis, in particular in the Merc, an opportunity to do rather well in the sprint race and then be absolutely nowhere in the race as they just push the setup direction way too far the other way. I mean, it's the argument for sprint races and more Parc Fermé is give the teams less time to nail down the perfect setup. But invariably, I think the Red Bull setup window is so wide and they've got it so well dialed in. And let's face it, I think the setup probably doesn't change too much from track to track. The aero setup will do, but I think most of the rest of it is what it is by now. Normally you'd say, well, less setup time, more variability, but this time round it seemed to be, yeah, open it up to change a few things. But we had the wonderful phenomena of the grass just randomly catching fire, which they think apparently they've worked out it could be an unwanted gas release, natural gas release, because it's built on old marshland, the circuit, so that just happens to be where there's a bit more gas bubbling up from the surface. So couple that with a titanium skid block spark, and the track just randomly catches fire. But I think they had a truck nearby and just the marshal just gently hosing the area down in between sessions. So it only happened twice, which was spectacular. But the other main talking point of somebody not paying attention to the Grand Prix at all was a certain Canadian Lance Stroll who went slamming into the back of Daniel Ricciardo and then proceeded to call him an idiot and say that it was a very weird racing incident and one of these, I think he was trying to say concertina, but it came out as Constantina, which or Constantinople, I'm not quite sure what he was referring to, but yeah, it was just that awful grin that he seems to have and then seemed to, you know, he ran up the back of Ricciardo, ruined his race, and then blamed it on him. And I think it takes a lot to get Danny Rick wound up. He'll be a little bit upset, and he's been upset a couple of times. What, Monaco with a bungled pit stop and the crash with Verstappen being two of them. But he said, bleep machine at the ready, this guy. And he said, well, if he can't work out that was his fault, then I can't help him. And but the bit where he said, oh, these idiots just stopped and I had nowhere to go, and friend of the podcast Karun Chandok quite ably pointed out the sort of 20-foot of open tarmac to the right where he could have gone, rather than tanking into the back of Ricciardo, who up until that point had been having a cracking weekend. He was on for a good result and seemed to have nailed down some of the issues. Going back to the shareholding thing in Tesla, for lots of the fractional shares I own in many companies, they send me a little thing to vote on the future. So I do wonder if Aston Martin are going to send me a thing to vote. I might vote myself in to become their new driver and Lawrence Stroll's new son. Because Lance needs he needs a bit of guidance, I think. If you run into the back of somebody, you really want to be just taking that on the chin and saying, yeah, sorry, that was my fault.
Right, so if you ran into somebody in the way that he did, ran into the back of somebody in the way he did on your driving test, you'd fail. And yet he wanted to blame just everybody else except himself. It was very, very clear that, yes, it was a difficult situation, but he should have been able to stop. Everybody else managed it. You know, it was a train of, what, four vehicles? He was number four and just piled into the back. You know, there was no excuse for it.
Oscar Piastri summed it up quite well because he said the same thing. He said, oh, yeah, everybody bunched up at their hairpin. And Oscar Piastri said, yeah, but there were 18 other people on track and nobody else crashed. And Verstappen's reaction to the replay of it in the cool-down room, he could just barely contain his laughter.
I mean, let's be, you know, blunt and call a spade a spade. If Daddy didn't own the team, he wouldn't be driving for them because he's simply... That's supposed to be the 20 or so best drivers in the world. And I don't think he has the right to be there.
No, I think you're quite right. But as a Remco ramp up their involvement and Honda come on board, you know, I think the Honda Alonso thing is going to be enough going on without having the second driver in the team not performing. But all the other investors in the team, all the other sponsors in the team, are they going to be happy with the boss's son cocking everything up? It's yeah, as I say, it's not so much the accident or the incident. These things happen, but you take it on the chin, you admit responsibility, and you get on with it and move on. There's, you know, plenty worse bumps and crashes and scrapes have happened with all the drivers over the last however many years and back to the dawn of time, but the proper ones get out of the car, have a chat, say sorry if it was their fault, and 5 minutes later they're all happy as Larry and they get on with it again. But yeah, to keep Daniel Ricciardo mad for a matter of hours is you've got to be a special breed to be able to do that.
It looks very immature.
I'm rather reminded of the famous Graham Hill quote from many years ago on a start line incident, and he said, listen, you don't go until the bloke in front of you goes. And this is the corollary of that. When the others stop, you stop without running into anybody.
These are the best drivers in the world, and he obviously has to be of a certain ability to even be within seconds of someone driving one of those cars. As it happens, Jim and I were looking at what could happen with Formula One. How loose could you make the rules and how wide would the gap get? And we were looking back at Silverstone and we're looking at fan cars and all kinds of things to see how far apart the gap was by comparison to sort of the beginning and the end of the grid as it is now. And it's amazing how tight it is, isn't it, really? Really, really tight.
Oh, yeah, it's the gap between first and last now is the equivalent to, you know, first to second in some seasons, or certainly first to 10th or first to 5th in seasons gone by. So everything is a lot narrower. And he's, you know, he's definitely got ability because he's produced some good drives and good wet weather drives and had a pole position and won stuff in the lower formula. So he can probably get a car around a circuit quicker than I can. But these are the 20 very best drivers. It's not good enough to be in the top 100, top 200. He's certainly in, you know, top 200, 300, 400 in the world, without a doubt. But he is not top 20. And it's the lap time and the special one-off is one thing. And he seems to do better at the more basic stop, brake, turn, go, stop, brake, turn, go. Well, maybe not with the stopping, but the stop-start circuits rather than the real driver's tracks like Suzuka, Silverstone and things like that. But the gulf between him and Alonso is just staggering. It's like they're in two different teams. You know, there's other drivers. You can have Lando, who had another mega weekend this weekend. The gap in qualifying between him and Oscar is reasonably close. Race pace, I think Oscar has more work to do on managing tyres and bits and pieces, but Oscar equips himself very well in wheel-to-wheel and just generally coping with the pace of F1. Lots of the other teammates, they're very, very narrow gaps. The biggest gulf at the moment is in the two Aston Martins. And, yeah, when there's other people to answer, it's not good enough.
I'm intrigued by Fernando signing a longer-term contract because I'm quite firmly of the view that that's not just about driving, that's about his future with Aston Martin in some other role than just as a driver. And similarly, I'm quite convinced that the Lewis move to Ferrari is not just about extending his driving career. It's about building a future relationship with a winning company. And I think that's what Fernando and Lewis are both doing. And we've seen others do that in the past, but not many. And they both, I think, have strategic values that they can carry into the team for the future. I mean, you know, Fernando is a master strategist. Doesn't matter what pressure he's under, he seems to be computing all this stuff in his head as he goes along. Lewis, I think, can still do this much the same, although not with the car that's currently sitting under him. But, you know, these are guys are really working out not just what they're doing, but what the rest of the team is doing or should be doing.
Yeah, I think Alonso signing the long-term deal at Aston Martin was a wise move. There were a few rumours of Fernando to Mercedes, which it's a sideways move, maybe slightly up. It's not getting you a championship-winning car. I think Fernando would have maybe gone to Red Bull if the offer was there, or things worked out, because you know he'd at least get a crack at the championship next year. Mercedes probably won't get a crack at it. They've got Kimi Antonelli waiting in the wings, so is he just a stopgap for a couple of years? And I think, you know, regular listeners to the podcast will know we've done an episode or two on F1 drivers' company cars, so pick your car from the manufacturer. And let's face it, if you had to pick a Mercedes or an Aston Martin or a Ferrari, I think it's reasonably easy to pick out of those three which ends up in third place, isn't it? So if you're going to go for an ambassadorial role, then yeah, I think Aston Martin or Ferrari is probably a wiser choice. So yeah, I think Fernando's nailed his colours to a nice green mast there and done quite well, and so has Lewis to a red mast. I think they've both done all right out of that, to be fair.
We're recording this towards the end of April. There's the curtain lifted for you and the fourth wall broken. But a couple of days ago, there was an episode of the BBC's investigative current affairs show, Panorama, which has been running for a few years, and some have argued it's not as good as it used to be, but then what is? But this one was very good, actually. It was very well researched, shall we say, all about so-called smart motorways and why they are basically so ridiculous, stupid, dangerous, lethal, insert your lethal epithet there. You'll obviously, anyone who's listened to the show over the years will know our views on so-called smart motorways, and we're not keen for the obvious. Yeah, it's come up in conversation a couple of times. We're not keen for the obvious reasons that basically they're lethal and stupid. But the BBC spoke to a lot of people who have a reason to have an opinion about them. Unfortunately, people who'd lost family members, people who'd been involved in accidents themselves, and obviously those from the motoring profession and the highways profession. So there's quite a gamut of commentators on there. So I strongly advise, if you have any interest in motoring, and if you have to use motorways, particularly smart motorways, you might find it a bit scary, but it'll open your eyes. I would strongly recommend watching it just to prepare yourself, if nothing else, because some of the revelations were quite astounding, like certain cameras and sensors that are supposed to pick you up within, I don't know, 20 seconds of you breaking down in a live lane weren't working for 5 days in some cases, which is a bit of a scary prospect, I think you'll all agree. Mm. I've mentioned before, and you know, we've spoken about the fact that I'm so paranoid about using them, and I drive a relatively new car that seems to work pretty well, touch wood, and lights up like a Christmas tree if I decide to switch on all the lights. But even I, being a bit paranoid, carry an orange flashing beacon that I can sort of whack on the roof Kojak style, just to hopefully give myself a little bit more chance of being seen if I'm in the unfortunate position of breaking down in a live lane. But I've got a friend, my mate Rob, who sometimes listens. Hello, Rob, if you're listening, and hopefully you will be in a position to carry on listening to this, given what I'm about to say. Rob's off to Halifax to collect a much beloved former classic of his that he's got back in his life. And, you know, congratulations, Rob. Molly is coming home. But it's a very, very early Morris Minor, which, as you can imagine, is not really ideally suited for motorways at the best of times. But dear Rob is very, very unhappy about the prospect of having to use smart motorways, and I don't blame him. The car's been fitted with hazard lights, which is something, which, you know, gives you a bit more advantage over any other classic of the era. But I mean, my personal recommendation, I think that of all of us, would be don't use motorways anyway if you don't have to. Take the back roads, which the car's far more suited to. And being in something that makes you feel as vulnerable as you're going to be in a 1950s, early 60s car, really, it doesn't bear thinking about what would happen if, you know, and you're more likely to break down, I'm afraid. We can't pull any punches there. I've recommended he gets himself a flashing orange light. And I don't know whether he's going to take me up on that. I think he has. It does make you think. I mean, they've said that they're not going to do any more. The government has stated there will be no more smart motorways going forward. But I think the general consensus from watching the excellent Panorama documentary was that most people think, rather than making the ones that we have now better, that the best course of action will be to roll back and put the motorways back as they were with a hard shoulder. And I don't know if the rest of you agree, but that's certainly my view.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
It's a sad state of affairs when it's 2024 and we live in a reasonably well-developed country with, you know, ignore the arguments over politics and the strength and state of our economy, etc. We are not a third-world country. This is Great Britain, or it's Britain at least, and it's 2024, and you have to turn around to somebody and say, well, actually, if you're driving a car and it's maybe a slightly older car, don't go on a smart motorway, because if you break down, there's a very good chance you will die. Or at the very best case scenario, you're out of the car, over the barrier, and stood there watching it as somebody goes tanking up the back of it and writes it off within a few hours of you buying it. But it's what a sad state of affairs, where you actively avoid a section of motorways, not because you don't like driving on a motorway, not because you're scared, not because you're looking to get some driving experience, you want to take the long way around and do the country roads, or you're out for a drive for fun, but to avoid a motorway in a developed country because you are worried you will die if you break down, that is ridiculous. And I think to say, oh, well, OK, we won't build any more of them is akin to, OK, well, we won't let any new people commit murder, but all those people who've done murders before, we're going to release them and allow them to kill again. So to be a legal murderer, you must have murdered before. So good news, serial killers only. It's utterly ridiculous, you know, and the government turns around and says, well, OK, we'll increase the smoking age by a year every year so there's no new generations of smokers. It's akin to that, isn't it? It's, you know, they're worried about that, but will quite happily allow ease a bit of congestion for the sake of a few people dying every year. It's nonsense. It's absolutely ridiculous.
I thought the single most alarming a piece of that program was a lady who is one of the leading campaigners against them as a result of her husband being killed a couple of years ago, who has a scenario now where whistleblowers from within the Highways Agency email her or text her or contact her to tell her which bits of the network aren't working, the cameras or the overheads or the signage or whatever, so that she can then put that on social media. And that's just bizarre. You know, this is Highways Agency failing to tell anybody, to alert anybody to the fact that the system is not working. It's just a killer.
I'll tell you what this is exactly akin to. We touched on the Toyota accelerator pedal kerfuffle, and actually the week that came out we bought a Toyota, but anyway, the government in this country, if a vehicle manufacturer has an issue with its vehicle that could be a safety related issue and could kill people, the law states that that vehicle manufacturer must A, not sell any vehicles until the problem is fixed, but B, must also ensure that they get all of the vehicles they've already sold back to the dealership to fix the issue, to make sure that it doesn't happen. So flip this around, and that's where a vehicle manufacturer, and we sell a vehicle, and oh yeah, the brakes can completely fail and catch fire and the accelerator pins itself, so you can't stop. Oh right, okay. Are you going to get it back and fix them? No, just the new ones that we sell won't do it anymore. All right, but what about the ones you've already sold? Oh yeah, they'll still do it. When? Oh, about a fifth of the time. But not all the time. No, only on certain bits of the road. Why? We'll let you know on Twitter so you know when to avoid them. Formerly known as X. No, X, formerly known as Twitter, whichever end of the subject of Elon again. It's that daft. It's like saying to a manufacturer, yes, all the death traps that you've sold, that's fine. Just don't do it anymore. It's ridiculous.
The thing is, if this was something else, like a plane, you'd have to have lots of fail-safes. Because if something bad happens, something bad is going to happen, wouldn't you?
Well, so if the door's falling off.
Yes, okay, but you, ignoring that, if you have, you know, computers, you've got a fly-by-wire plane, so you've got a computer, so you have a redundancy and a redundancy, yeah? Let's just assume that this all worked properly and it was okay. You'd still expect there to be enough redundancies that if something happened, there would always be a fail-safe, wouldn't you?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
At the very least, the fail-safe should be, if it doesn't know, close the inside lane.
Yeah.
The default position is closed. And unless everybody has their finger on the button to say, yes, this is green and it's okay, then the leftmost lane remains closed. And that's it. Yep. Only if somebody is able to 100% verify that everything is okay, do they keep their finger on the button and then the lane is open. Other than that, if something goes wrong, the lane's shut. Simple as that. And it's a very easy solution. Just announce that on all smart motorways now, the inside lane is an X. It's closed. It's back to the hard shoulder. Put the X up and introduce a 12-month ban for anybody caught driving in a lane with the X on it. Simple as that.
That's the thing, though, isn't it? How many people don't seem to be able to recognise either an X, a red X, red, anything that just basically says you shouldn't be in this lane. I mean, you should have been out of that lane way back because all the arrows were telling you to do that. Yet still, you get people come flying up to the scene, literally the scene of an accident, and wondering why, oh my God, I've had to slam the brakes on. It's because nobody knows what they're doing. No one's paying attention. And the education of how to use a motorway is still absolutely parlous. Yes, you're allowed to learn to drive on motorways now, but they haven't increased any of the training. From what I understand, the knowledge of what to do on a motorway is still absolutely lacking. The highway code still doesn't really approach it very well. And I mean, I do know a little bit about this. My brother's learning to be a driving instructor, and he said the same thing. The knowledge about how to train people to drive on motorways is basically, you'll be all right, you'll be on your own. They're the safest roads in Britain. Well, they used to be until they introduced the bloody smart motorway concept. Now they're rapidly falling down behind rat runs, back roads, country lanes, single lane tracks, anything you can basically put in front of it. And I think that's part of the problem. There's a combination of people going, well, this doesn't apply to me, or not knowing, or not looking, or caring about the fact there's a big red X above the lane that you're meant to have got out of about a mile away.
Of course, nobody seems to understand merge in turn either, because when you do come up to a set of roadworks or something like that, people actively stop you from using both lanes and then merging in turn at the end of it. And I've been stuck in a 4, 5, 6 mile tailback at 3 o'clock in the morning when, you know, really the volume of cars should be absolutely fine for one lane on the motorway. And there was a section where it was down to one lane for roadworks, but because everybody was belting up, as you said, and storming up at the last minute and ignoring the red X signs, the tailback was absolutely horrific. And it's, the education's just got to get a lot better. And putting out a stupid advert with so-and-so used to drive like an absolute bellend, but he now looks at this and now he doesn't drive like a bellend and he's a really smug idiot. It just doesn't wash. Or that stupid advert with the wasps or whatever it was stuck on the windscreen. It just doesn't wash. It's not good enough.
I think that's a good note to end on. Yeah, we ain't happy.
Well, actually, I think the end of the podcast is, our advice is, if you're in an old and possibly slightly questionably unreliable car, do not drive on a motorway. So over the next week, Mike, what are you going to be doing?
Well, there's good news. I'm now feeling great about the prospect of driving back from the tuners in the Onion, having taken it up to get it mapped, and the first drive that I shall have in the car since building the engine and putting everything together and fitting the engine management and everything else myself will be to drive back potentially along a motorway. And let's face it, even hard shoulders aren't safe, really, are they?
So if you'd like to send in your messages of condolence now to UK Motor Talk, we are at UK Motor Talk on all the socials. So it's From me, Jim, it's been nice chatting to you all, and it's been nice knowing you, Mike.
Well, I'd just like to say you have been listening to, and at this point, if we could afford the theme tune, we'd probably queue up Dad's Army or something. Yes, it's been an absolute pleasure. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Good night and goodbye. Safe journey.
From me, Dave, I'll just say # pray for onion. See you next time, hopefully. Cheers.
UK Motor Talk, a First Take Media production.
That's going to be trending.